Welcome to the Sons of Technology Clubhouse. Ditch your fear at the door, take a risk, and enjoy the ride with your hosts, Joe Marquez and Kyle Anderson.
Welcome, everybody, to another fantastic episode of the podcast by the Sons of Technology. And you know what? It has been a minute since we have posted an episode. We're going to talk a little bit about that as we go along. We're going to also be talking about social media, mainly Twitter, because that's where I got my feet dipped, my toes dipped into the pool of social media to really dive into what social media can do for me as a professional educator. But have things changed since then? Since 2008, 2010, have things changed since then? But before we do, let's go ahead and reintroduce ourselves. If this is your first time listening, or you know, you haven't listened to us in a while, my name is Joe Marquez, Director of Academic Innovation for Q, and I'm an educator out of the Central Valley of California. And I'm so happy to be back chatting with you. And then, as always, my partner in innovation, Kyle Anderson. Kyle, please introduce yourself.
It has indeed been a minute since we posted an episode. And like you said, yes, we will get into the reasons why that has not happened. But again, first time listener, long time listener, whatever you are, I am Kyle Anderson. I am a special education facilitator out of Las Vegas. You can find me on Twitter at Anderson EdTech. Same thing with Instagram. I am also on Peloton at that same handle. So if you're a Peloton user, you can connect with me on there. I have a blog that I've not written on in quite a while, AndersonEdTech.net. So a lot of great stuff still there. I do need to get back into the writing. And that kind of ties into the whole social media thing as to why I haven't been writing too. And then I do have a book called To the Edge, Successes and Failures to Risk Taking. That's on Amazon. It's on BarnesandNoble.com. It is also available through my publisher, EduMatch Publishing. And Joe, when we talked about what we were going to talk about with this episode of social media, we did kind of tie it into just some of the quote-unquote turmoil on social media recently. I mean, we did just finish up here in the United States with a pretty contentious election cycle that actually didn't turn out to be nearly as bad as I thought it was going to be. The lead-up was way worse than the actual election itself, in my opinion, and we can talk a little bit about that. But also recent developments with a certain somebody. I'm not going to mention the name of this somebody in fear of they hear this and then block my Twitter account. So, but that person and some of the changes happening at Twitter for the good, maybe, but I'm anticipating more for the not so good, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and that's just going to be a small portion of what we're going to talk about, right? But that is kind of the crux of you know, how we came up with the idea of talking about this today, right? When we started this podcast, we always said we wanted to talk about current events, current things that are happening that will affect teachers, that will affect education, and we don't mind getting our hands dirty in doing it. And you know, we may be voicing our opinions, we may be voicing the opposite of our opinions just to invoke, you know, a conversation with each other. But, you know, I have to say that for me, and I would say this all the time, for me, social media or Twitter really helped me in identifying new things to experiment with in my classroom, or it, you know, by following multiple educators and seeing what they're doing, it kind of reinforced my mindset that what I was doing in my classroom was not crazy, right? Like, there are other people out there trying these things or trying similar things to varying degrees of success. But it kind of re-solidified, like, in my mind, you know, like, I may be the weirdo on my campus, but I can't be a weirdo if there's so many people doing these new and crazy things. And maybe if you're listening and you're a newer educator or you're a veteran educator, you know, like, you have to think back. This is back in 2008, 2009, 2010, what I'm talking about, when, you know, EdTech really started kind of ramping up around this time, because Chromebooks started coming out and becoming more affordable for the classrooms. And, you know, they started getting more prolific in districts. And, you know, the term one-to-one started coming out. That meant, you know, the computers were being removed from the computer lab and then being put in the hands of students for content-based activity. And that was a big shift in the early days of EdTech, right? Instead of walking your class to the computer lab to learn this or that, you're giving the kids computers, giving the students computers, and teachers needed to know how to help to unleash that power, right? We didn't just want students to use them as a word processor instead of writing it out with paper pencil. We didn't want students to just use it as a research tool instead of having to go to the library. We wanted them to really harness the power of what a computer could do. And social media allowed me to get a window into what other educators across the state and across the globe were actually doing. And so I feel at the very beginning, it was a community of educators sharing out what was going on in their classroom, sharing out, you know, what they were doing or going through or changing or shifting, you know, connecting it to SAMR or connecting it to ISTE standard. But they were sharing these things out and giving people ideas. And I was telling you this, Kyle, it's kind of like when I first moved in to my current neighborhood here in town. When I moved in, it was in an existing neighborhood, but the cul-de-sac that was what the houses were being built on was new. They just built the cul-de-sac portion, you know, kind of like the appendix of this neighborhood, just this thing that shot off out to the side. And so we were new to this larger neighborhood, but we really gravitated towards one another. And it just so happened that, four out of the five houses on the block were teachers, were educators. And so we were able to have like community block parties and talk shop, and we really got connected with one another, and people would bring brownies or cookies to one another. They would really share. But as with any neighborhood, people age out or grow, and they want to move into a bigger house. And we had the neighbor to the right of me who coached football with me. And he was one of my really good friends. He and his family moved out. The neighbors to the other side of me, who taught in the same school district as myself, they ended up moving out. And then just people I never connected with moved in to either side of me. And it felt almost like the community was changing, was shifting, to be more isolated houses rather than a community. Each house was doing what they wanted to do to make them feel better instead of helping everybody else out to make the community feel a little bit better. And we'll talk a little bit more and dive into this more, but I think somehow I think I feel the same of my neighborhood of Twitter, where the community of helping is still there. But we have a lot of people who have moved in, and it's more about I, look at me, bring me to your district kind of stuff. And that kind of turns me off a little bit. And you know, everybody's got a livelihood. Everybody's got, you know, what do they call it? Everybody's got their side hustle, you know, and more power to them. But, you know, the community I moved into in Twitter has gradually shifted more in that direction. And it's caused me pause to actually be on Twitter more and more. And so I don't post very often because if I don't have something to contribute, I feel like there's no reason for me to post. So I haven't been posting as much. And that trickles into more and more things, but I want to hear your, Kyle, your aspect of that. Does that sound like a familiar story to you, or what has been your shift in Twitter, if there has been one?
Oh, there's definitely been a shift. And I mean, I do need to go back to the beginning, kind of like you did. You were talking about being on Twitter back in 2009, 2010. I didn't get on Twitter until 2015. So I was a little behind the game in that regard. And in my initial reservations about it was because I didn't see it as a way to enhance my profession or to connect with that other educators. My view of Twitter was that it was celebrity gossip and political bickering, you know, and really, a lot of Twitter is that, and it still is that, if not even more so that now because of the way Twitter has shifted. So I wasn't on it for a long time. I didn't see it as something beneficial to me. And I was on Facebook, and I still am on Facebook, but I mean, I've been talking for years about just dumping Facebook, but you know, there's little things that I stay there, you know, to keep those connections with family and friends from yesteryear that I don't have the ability to see on a regular basis or connect with in another way. And then for some aspects of connecting with other educators as well. So when I jumped into Twitter, though, finally in 2015, I realized that, like you keep calling it a community. It was a community of people that I was not the only one trying to do a lot of those things, experimenting with different tech tools or different ways of getting content to students that wasn't just the traditional stand and deliver and whatnot. So there was a community out there, and it created this, it opened this door for me to meet all sorts of different people, not only just online and share ideas and connect online, but then eventually in person as well. I mean, you and I met in person as a result of Twitter, and you know, some of my best friends now, Adam Juarez being another great example, I met them through Twitter, and now we are people that we realize that, you know, had we met in person years ago, like just like what kind of a relationship we would have, you know, and it's only just been a few short years. I mean, 2015 seems so long ago, but I'm coming up on my 8th Twitter anniversary. They send you that tweet every year, like it's your Twitter anniversary. So that 8th one will be coming up here in a couple of months. But as time's gone on, that community has gotten smaller, in my opinion. It has become more of a place where I refer to it as toxic positivity. And I know a lot of other people do as well, where it's just like the look at me, look at all this great stuff I'm doing, or a self-promotion site is what it's become as well. Like and that's not why I got on Twitter. I got on Twitter to ask questions and to connect with people and share ideas. And to me, it's not so much it's not the sharing of ideas anymore. It's the promoting of ideas, a self-promotion. And we used to do Twitter chats. Man, I had my calendar, my Google calendar, I had notifications set up for no less than probably half a dozen Twitter chats throughout the week to remind me, you know, 15 minutes, half an hour before they were going to start, hey, you got this coming up. So I could jump on my computer and participate in these chats. And then, you know, that's when I was using programs like TweetDeck, where instead of being on Twitter, like you could set up the columns in TweetDeck to see the tweets coming in and then respond to them. And even setting up like auto tweets for yourself to participate in Twitter chats as well. So rather than having to spend the time doing the introduction, because all the Twitter chats always started with like, who are you? Where are you at? Tell us about yourself, blah, blah, blah. You would just have the auto tweet that, you know, that like at 7:01 PM, they're going to ask this question. So at 7:02, just have it automatically post and you don't have to worry about it. That way you can focus on responding to others and connecting with them. And then I would even host the Twitter chats every now and then where I would have the questions auto post at certain times throughout the Twitter chat time. And then that way I could focus on interacting with people, responding to questions or commenting on things that they said. And it was so funny because you would get these engagement statistics on Twitter, and I'm sure they're still there. I haven't checked them in a long time, where you would see that during this hour, you tweeted 57 times or something, like it was something nuts. And I don't know if I've tweeted 57 times in the last 6 months, to tell you the truth now, because I just like it's never been about likes or interaction, but when I don't know how many people really see the stuff I'm posting now anyway. So it's one of those deals where like, I just don't know how much I'm really being an influence on Twitter now at this point. And again, it was never about likes, but I could post something really, really thoughtful and in my opinion, really useful and get absolutely no reaction whatsoever. Yet then somebody that just has, you know, all sorts of followers post something just absolutely asinine. And then they get 500 retweets on something that's just absolutely stupid, in my opinion. So, you know, instead of asking a thoughtful question about like, how do we solve X problem in the clash or whatever, it's something ridiculous like, what do you prefer in the morning, Red Bull, Monster, or coffee? And then you get 900 responses to that. And that's frustrating. That is not why I got onto Twitter. And then I understand that as educators, politics are very important and we need to be political in order to get the change that is needed in education. And you know, discussing politics and supporting candidates that are going to support education, those are all very important things. But I also did not get on Twitter to see constant political conversations and ads, especially ones that are very, very partisan. So extreme to either side, whether to the right or to the left. I did not get on Twitter for that. And I will say that in the scrolling that I have done over the last few months, I see more and more educators that they're not posting about education. They're just posting about politics. And sometimes the politics have nothing to do with education. And I will say I've unfollowed a lot of people as a result of that, because again, it's not why I got on Twitter. I'm not unfollowing you because I disagree with you. I'm unfollowing you because I don't want to see that. That's not why I'm there. So, and it's the same thing with Facebook. I've unfollowed or even blocked some people just because that's not why I'm here. I don't need to see that kind of stuff. So, and part of it's also for my own sanity, because I mean, how many studies have been done over the last few years that social media in general has caused issues with self-esteem, with stress, etc. And it's for my own sanity. I know if I can get rid of some of that toxicity in my social media feeds, then it's not going to cause me stress. And I've also taken steps to make sure I don't get on social media as much just because of that just useless doom scrolling that sometimes happens, where you get into Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever, and you just mindlessly scroll. And then all of a sudden, like 30 minutes later, you're like, what did I just do for the last half an hour? I did absolutely nothing but just scroll through this. And a lot of times you're not even interacting. You're literally just scrolling and reading. So I have on my phone, I have things set up to where if I'm on some social media site for X amount of time, I'm going to get a notification that you have 5 minutes left for the day. Could I go in and change those notifications and turn it back? Yeah, I could, but I don't. I think for Twitter, I have 15 minutes per day. And I think Facebook, I have 30 minutes per day. Instagram, I barely get on anyway, because I'm just not a picture person. I don't take a lot of pictures, so I don't post a lot on there. And my posting, I mean, I already mentioned Twitter. I don't post much on there anymore. I don't post much on any social media site for that matter anymore. So I just have found ways to be engaged in other ways and to connect with people in other ways. And a lot of it is that because I have become friends with people outside of social media, I have direct phone numbers for those people now, where if I need to talk to somebody, I can either text them or call them. I mean, you're one of them, obviously. Adam Juarez is one of those people that, you know, he's part of this community of the Sons of Technology that I've connected with now over several years. So now these are people that I know and I trust, and I can ask questions and have meaningful conversation that way rather than over social media. So yeah, it has definitely shifted for me. And as much as I used to love the Twitter chat, my partner on Beer EDU podcast, he ran a Twitter chat for the last 8-9 years, the Teach NV chat. And he actually killed it over the last month or so, because he said he thinks that the Twitter chat has run its course, where people aren't participating as much. He said that while it wasn't a lot of work that went into it, he said that the work that was going to it, he thought was kind of futile, where, you know, the same handful of people were showing up every week and like nothing against him, but it was a lot of the same responses to different topics and whatever. And he just, again, he said that he didn't feel that putting in the time for something that was, it's almost like, you know, the people that still read the regular newspaper, you know, there's a few out there that do that, but most people get their news online at this point. And he felt the Twitter chat, it was the same way, where there's going to be people out there that still enjoy the Twitter chat, but most people have kind of moved on from it.
Yeah. You touched on a lot of really important points. Like one of them, the Twitter chat, you know, Q used to do a Twitter chat, I believe it was every Tuesday. You know, that stopped and people like, are you going to start that Twitter chat again? I'm like, Twitter chats, if you look, have really gone downhill, right? It takes more to put one together than you get back from it. And you're absolutely right. It's usually the same people that join in, if they join in at all. I had been a part of another Twitter chat, the California Educator Twitter chat, that was going for quite a long time. I was a moderator and for those. And that ended up folding about a year ago because they saw the numbers dwindling. It was taking more time and effort to put it together than there was actual participation being brought out of it. And so it was brought up to me like, hey, are you going to start, you know, with your position at Q, you know, are you going to start a Twitter chat again? And I go, I do think there is a place for a weekly Q&A, right? But I don't think a Twitter chat is that. I don't think, I think like what you said, Kyle, it's run its course. I think if I were to revive the weekly Q chat, I'd call it even a Q chat, not a Twitter chat, I would maybe dabble in Twitter spaces a little bit. I'd want to play around with it a little bit more to see what's all involved in it. Maybe a Twitter spaces where people could answer verbally. I don't know if those are archived or saved, though. I love things to be able to be archived and saved. And if you can't archive and save a spaces, then I don't really see the long-term benefit of it. Then I was thinking, well, why not a StreamYard, right? Where, you know, you can have the live conversations and you can even, you know, like if somebody asks a really good question, you could find out where they're at, send them a direct message. Hey, you want to join us and ask that question live and maybe have like a pull from the audience kind of a deal. Or I was actually thinking something of a hybrid, right? Because I have a Rodecaster here. So I was wondering if I could start a Twitter spaces on my phone, Bluetooth my phone audio into the audio of the StreamYard and then have people ask questions that way and then archive it. So there's a lot of things that I've been thinking about, but not bringing back a Twitter chat. That's the least of what I was thinking about. Because we really have to admit to ourselves that communication and availability of information has evolved, especially in the last 10 years. And if we continue to try and push for the way we connected and did things together 10 years ago without evolving, well, then, you know, we're kind of taking away from, you know, our warrior call, our calling card of, you know, you shouldn't be doing the same thing in your classroom that you were doing 10 years ago. You should have evolved, right? So why are we still trying to rest on the same things we were using previously? And I think that is where, for me, maybe I don't want to say Twitter has run its course, but it's changed to the point where I don't get out of it what I used to. So I have to look elsewhere. And then also, you know, working with Q, we use a posting platform called Hootsuite, where we can post to multiple platforms at the same time to make sure we're getting the information out to all the places people may be. They even just added a TikTok. So I'm thinking to myself, maybe I should look into doing some quick TikToks for Q, kind of a deal. But the interesting thing about that is Twitter, they give you an analytics dashboard, like the success rate of your post in all different platforms. And Twitter is consistently the lowest. It's consistently the lowest in actionable getting out of what you're putting into it. The highest has been Instagram. I think I've seen a lot of educators go more towards the Instagram than the Twitter. And I think it's because there is no word limit on Instagram. And if you're associating, it doesn't have to be a photo. It can just be an image that you've created and posted on Instagram, right? So maybe almost the same kind of post you would do on Twitter, but you would move into Instagram, right? The only difference with Instagram is there's no re-instas or anything, like, you know, and I don't know how, you know, how those things get, but we are getting the most interactions and the most clicks on our links. Well, you can't click on links, but the most interactions through the Instagram. And then the second one, of course, is Facebook. And personally, I don't like touching foot in Facebook at all. But I think people educators are gradually looking for different ways to interact, a different experience than Twitter proper, for a lot of the reasons we've talked about.
Yeah, and you mentioned some of these pitfalls of the various platforms. Like Twitter has its limit on the amount of characters, but I don't necessarily see that as being a problem, because sometimes you'll see sometimes where there'll be a tweet and then you'll see where someone has typed in there one of X amount of tweet, and like you end up reading this whole thread. It's like 15 separate tweets and whatever. It's like that could have been a Facebook rant at that point. So yeah, you don't have the character limits on Instagram, but then again, like you mentioned, you don't have the ability to click on a link in Instagram. I believe you have to put the link either in your profile or some other way. So that's a limitation there as well. And then with Facebook, then you know that has its own issues or whatever. So it's almost like if you could take all the positive aspects of each of these platforms and put it into one platform, that would be ideal. But then there becomes the issue of misinformation that clouds all of those programs, in my opinion. And I can get into that more here in a second. So, and then, you know, I've already mentioned, I am not a person that takes a lot of pictures. I'm not so much of a visual person. I'm more of like a, like read or an auditory type of person. So an Instagram doesn't do much for me in that regard. And then again, I think Instagram, just the overall culture of Instagram, in my opinion, is that it's so much, hey, look at me to begin with. So whereas, you know, when Twitter used to be where you could post something asking a legitimate question or trying to gather some ideas or whatever, Instagram doesn't have that. To me, it's more of a promotional tool. And, you know, we use Instagram for the Beer EDU pod to just put stuff out, like, hey, we got a new episode. So, I mean, I'm guilty of it too, just putting out a promotional thing. But I don't necessarily word it or imply it when I put it out there, like, ooh, look at us or whatever. It's just more of like a, hey, we got a new episode. You want to check it out, go check it out kind of a thing. So, and then TikTok, to me, I don't watch a lot of videos. A lot of people have the whole where they'll fall into the rabbit hole of YouTube where they'll sit there for an hour mindlessly just watching videos. And TikTok has become the same thing. I don't have a TikTok. I have no intention of getting a TikTok because I'm not one of those people that just sits there and watches videos like that. I just do not fall in that rabbit hole, and I don't want to fall down those rabbit holes. So I have YouTube on my phone, but the YouTube on my phone is more for every now and then. Like if something breaks in my house, if I can fix it, I go to YouTube and figure out if I can fix it. That's the YouTube on my phone. And I can't tell you the last time I pulled up YouTube on a computer to look at something. I try not to fall down those holes. And TikTok is one that has that potential. And you hear about people that were, again, it's kind of like the doom scrolling in Facebook or Instagram where, yeah, I just wasted an hour and a half watching TikTok videos. So it's just not something I necessarily want to get into. So, but kind of circling back to the misinformation thing, too. I mean, that has been a problem really since the beginning of time. This isn't a social media issue. Misinformation has always been a problem. In fact, I was actually just listening to an episode of a podcast today. It's why am I drawing a blank on the name of the podcast now? I think it's called 1 Year, where they will do 6, 7, 8 episodes of different aspects of things that went on in 1 year in our history. And this season is 1942. So right after Pearl Harbor, and then different aspects of society at that time. Now, there was a great episode from a couple of weeks ago that looked at the spike in marriages during the year of 1942, because all these young men that were either enlisting or getting drafted, they would get married either right before they got shipped out or right when they would come back for a quick leave or whatever, and they would get married. So, and then they tied that to a few years later, the spike in divorces that took place, because these men were getting married in 1942. They come home 1945, 46 and realize they married somebody that is not the same person anymore. And now all of a sudden they're getting divorced. So that was interesting. But the episode that I listened to today was about the misinformation and propaganda campaigns on both the Allied side and the Axis side during that year. And the focus of the episode was all of the misinformation that an American who basically, he was an embassy worker for the United States stationed in Berlin when the war broke out, and he basically sold out and then started working for the propaganda minister of Nazi Germany, and then doing this radio program that was just feeding lies into the American public and whatever, and how that was such a major issue. Well, so, I mean, that's just an example that misinformation is not new. Social media is rife with misinformation, but it's not a new concept. It's just in a way that is more accessible to more people. So my fear right now is that it's already a major issue, and now the new CEO, the new owner of Twitter, has expressed multiple times that they want to be a bastion of free speech on Twitter. And right off the bat, as soon as he purchased it, you've got all these people that testing the waters. Are we going to get moderated and have our stuff blocked? So now they're just throwing stuff out there left and right. And I think Twitter is now going to become it's going to become even worse than what it is now, because in the name of free speech, this person's not going to moderate anything, and it's just going to become worse. And while my Twitter feed, I don't see a lot of that stuff because I've carefully curated my stuff. And if I see any inkling of that coming from anybody I follow, I unfollow them. And if it's really bad, I block them, because that is not why I'm on Twitter. But not every Twitter user is like me. And there are some people where they fall into that trap of believing a lot of that misinformation, and then they continue to spread that misinformation. You know, Facebook's the same way. I have either unfollowed or blocked people on Facebook because of the traps they have fallen into with misinformation. And that's not why I'm there. I don't necessarily think you're a terrible person because you believe certain things. There are some things where I do think you're a terrible person if you believe them and promote them. But that's not why I'm on social media, but that's not everybody. And I believe that, like you said, you don't necessarily think that Twitter or social media in general has run its course, but it has definitely changed since I was a prominent social media user.
I mean, things change over time, right? The way that information is put out changes over time. Social media has proved that. The problem is, a lot of people see on social media a statement, and instead of taking it as opinion, they take it as either fact or news. And the problem with social media is anybody can say anything. The cool thing about social media is anybody can say anything, right? So free speech is a double-edged sword. You have to make sure, though, that speech, I would say, especially on social media, that speech is labeled. It needs to be labeled as opinion, or it needs to be labeled as news. And this is what I'm saying to you here, is I was posed a question. I think the person who posed this question is probably going to be listening to this podcast. But he posed this question. He goes, what's the difference between the new owner of Twitter purchasing Twitter and Jeff Bezos purchasing the Washington Post? I don't know why nobody was up in arms about Jeff Bezos purchasing the Washington Post as much as everybody's up in arms about this person purchasing Twitter. Well, I tell you the difference is in journalism, there are rules. There are rules, there are libels, there are fact checks that have to be proven, that due diligence was taken effect. And they have to label articles as either opinion, meaning this is somebody's opinion, and then the others are reported news articles based on facts. The papers have to do that. It doesn't have to be done in social media or on Twitter.
Correct. And it's, and to kind of piggyback on that too, even the websites that tend to lean one way or the other, they still abide by those rules as well for the most part. So some news organizations, I'm throwing up air quotes here, okay, they do not do that, and that's not considered news at that point. And I love that chart that comes out every year that kind of shows where these news organizations fall on the spectrum or whatever. And your most credible ones, AP News is the one that I tend to stick, because that is straight middle of the road. That one's always right in the middle, and then you'll see the other ones as well. So I apologize for interrupting that, but I just wanted to throw that into.
Oh, no, but what I say is, truly, how many people read the Washington Post? How many people read their Facebook feed every day, right? I guarantee you there are more Americans that get their news from their Facebook feed than they do from the Washington Post. More individuals who get their news from their Twitter feed than another news organization. And the majority of that news that they get is the titles. They don't actually go in to read the article. They read the clickbait, right? But they don't click, right? And so they're getting these sound bites or word bites, and they think that's news. And that's a problem. And here, I want to go back to some of the changes being made to Twitter right now that could be detrimental. And I you know, people, you know, can correct me if I'm wrong or voice their opinions on if I'm being overly critical of it. But one of the things that was special to Twitter was that blue check mark. Now, people like, that's just for elites, or that's just for celebrities, or the blue check mark is meant not as a status symbol, but it's meant to identify, hey, if something comes from this person or entity, it's not to say that it's true or anything, but it came from that person or entity.
Like, yeah, it's a verification. You and I could have gotten a blue check if we wanted to.
Well, we couldn't. Here's the reason. No?
Okay, because no. I was under the impression that I could get a blue check previously. So maybe enlighten me on this.
Yeah.
Now.
So a blue check is meant to be for people of stature. Meaning, if somebody faked this account and said something, that it would destroy the career of this individual, or it would cause a panic because of the information being put out there. For example, if somebody pretended to be Barack Obama and they got a blue check mark next to it, people would say that was Barack Obama. He's got a blue check mark. It's been verified. It's been vetted. If anybody could just get a check mark, then anybody can find a way to impersonate people. And there's a reason I'm saying this. Because Twitter on Wednesday enacted a new policy. Anybody who pays $8 a month can get a blue check mark. And so an 18-year-old college kid went on and created an account as one of ESPN's top NFL news analysts and put that guy's name as the name, and then put his handle as the guy's name, and then in the number zero, and then T, so not, right? And then in the personal part of that, it says, this is a parody account, I'm not really this person. But it doesn't show that on a tweet. It shows the person's name and the check mark. And he went on and said, Josh McDaniels, the head coach of the Raiders, has been fired. Then he said LeBron James is demanding a trade from the Lakers. And then he went on and said Justin Fields from the Bears has been suspended for promoting anti-Semitic beliefs. And people are retweeting this, thinking it is that analyst from ESPN who has a verified vetted checkmark. And everybody was going, oh, what's going on? All this stuff is happening today. Because of the blue check mark, they thought it was a verified account, meaning they took what that person was saying as truth, because the real person who has that check mark is pretty reliable when it comes to information being broken about sports. That actually is one of the reasons that that whole program was shut off, because he proved that this kid proved it's not a reliable way to get a blue check mark by paying. Because more and more of this is going to happen.
Yeah. I do believe, though, previously, before these new developments, though, that there were ways that, like, you and I could get verified. I don't know what they were. And
you could apply for it, but you would most likely get denied for it. They would say your status or your number of follower, it doesn't equate to needing verification.
And that's what I was referring to previously, not on these newer developments. So now, the other issue, too, that social media has become that I have issues with, and another reason why I've gotten away from it so much, is how ads drive so much of what your feed is now. So I think I was actually talking to you one day about how I cannot scroll through, say, Instagram now without an ad probably every other four or five posts. It's either an ad for a company or it's a quote unquote promoted post, or in Twitter, a promoted tweet, where, and it identifies in there that it's a promoted tweet or an ad. There's a way to show, but it is, I mean, you cannot scroll through without seeing that. Like, Instagram is the worst, in my opinion. It's like every four or five. Facebook has gotten like that as well. Twitter is not as bad with the promoted tweets or the ads, but that's becoming an issue too, where you go through and you're trying to see stuff and like it is an ad over and over again. Now, 99.9% of the time, I keep scrolling and don't want to see anything. But there are two things where that have happened either in the past or recently where an ad has come to be something that I've actually clicked on and worked out in my favor. There's a company in my area that every 6 weeks will come out to your house and they will power wash your garbage and recycling bins that you put out on the curb. I discovered that through an Instagram post, an ad. And now every 6 weeks I pay $25 and they power wash my stuff. That's something I don't want to do. And it should be done because that's disgusting. Well, then.
Yeah. We just got that service as well.
Yeah. It's great. If you're watching this on YouTube or Facebook, the flannel shirt that I'm wearing came from a Facebook ad. I saw this shirt and it is a flannel shirt that is Pennywise, the band, and their album Full Circle. It is a collaboration between the band and the flannel shirt company. And it's got a little Pennywise logo on the one pocket. I bought that because of a Facebook ad, but most of them, I just keep scrolling and get away from it. So now, in my opinion, we pay for subscription services for just about everything in our world now today. You know, whether it's a streaming service like Disney Plus or Netflix or whatever, I have a subscription to the power washing for my garbage cans, whatever it is. You want to improve social media, and social media companies still need to make their money in order to keep operating. Why is there not a premium account for social media that has nothing to do with a blue check and being verified or anything like that, but it's for people who just want to either eliminate or at least reduce the amount of ads that are in their feeds? So if I want to continue to use Facebook or Instagram with minimal, I would pay a small fee for that every month. So podcast organizations do it, where the podcast I was mentioning earlier, the 1 year, they're under a company called Slate, and they have a whole umbrella podcast, and you can get, I believe it's called Slate Plus, that for like $5 a month, you can get any show of theirs ad free. There's also, I know NPR does a premium version now where you can get their podcasts without ads. So if podcast companies are doing it, if social or streaming services are doing these premium accounts without ads, why can't social media companies do it too? And I believe that would really truly improve the social media experience, because you're not going to see all the ads and you're not going to see all the promoted tweets that, well, frankly, some of them are just ridiculous. So I have a certain look about myself. I am a white male. I am bald. I have a large beard. Some people may look at me and have thoughts about what my political beliefs may be. Facebook and Instagram algorithms have taken my face and my look, and I am curated various ads that of things that I most certainly do not agree with. And it's frankly getting kind of annoying that I do not need to see ads from these companies, because I do not believe in that stuff. And it's strictly because they have used my profile picture to curate ads to me just because of a certain look that I have. So I'm all for premium accounts for social media as a result.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that the idea of paying for an adless experience, or and also so they don't take your analytics, that's another key part of it, right? There's that saying, if you're not paying, you're the product, right? And so you are the product. You're the thing being sold. That's why all these ads are able to be targeted at you. If you are able to pay so that your information and your analytics cannot be used outside of your account, that'd be a beneficial, right? The one thing that's a bad side of this coin is I'm hearing through a couple of different articles that I've read that Twitter Blue is they want to give status to anybody who pays $8 a month to get their tweets in front of more people's eyes. So instead of it being organic, like people start see it and they like it, and then it starts climbing up the feed because, you know, the virality of it, by paying the $8, your information gets in front of more eyes just because you paid that monetary fee. And Elon Musk, I said his name. What he said was this.
You're getting blocked now.
He said, speech should be free, but reach should not be. That's basically what he said. So he said, anybody can say anything, but if you pay, we'll get your reach higher up. And so can that be abused, right? Can that be abused? People that don't have the means or the funds to spend $8 a month on this social media, their stuff doesn't get in front of as many eyes as some other people who can get it in front. So that could be an issue, right? But I'll tell you, you know, we're going to start wrapping up right here. I'm not running for the hills, right? I'm not running for the hills. I'm not canceling my Twitter account. I've seen people saying, I'm running to Mastodon, right? I don't even know what that is, but I've heard that. I'm going to Mastodon. More power to you.
Great prog metal band, by the way. So if you've never listened to Mastodon, go check them out. They're great.
But what I'm trying to say is things have evolved and things have changed. We have evolved in our careers, and the point where we're at have changed. And maybe our point of view is skewed now because of where we are at compared to where people just getting started are at, right? And so maybe it's not just the platform that has changed. Maybe it is our view that has changed. And a lot of people who are just getting into ed tech, I still say go on Twitter. I'm not saying stop. I mean, it is a great place for information. There are a lot of great educators who are givers, okay? I think the point we were trying to make is we've seen the shift where a large percentage of individuals were givers. Now I think it's still a large percentage, but we're having a gradual increase of more promoters. And, again, there's nothing wrong with that. But it's not my Twitter, right? It's not my community. It doesn't mean it should stop. I'm not telling anybody you need to stop promoting yourself or your book or your website or your podcast or your training materials. I'm not saying you need to stop and you should stop. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that's not the community that I'm following, right? I am looking for the teachers in the classroom doing amazing things and sharing out. Look at the lesson my kids did and look what they created. Here's a tutorial on how I did that. Here's how I reached that. I love that. That help, because you're helping other educators to try and figure out a way to emulate that and change things up. So that's what I want to see more of. And so that's what I encourage each and every one of us to do, is those lessons that worked, those risks that you took and worked, share them out. Write a blog post about them. Share them out. That's not self-promotion when you're showing something that you tried and created and did, and you just want to share it with the community. Share it out. Write that blog post. But lay out, you know, I had difficulty at the beginning. I think that's another thing about social media. It creates a rainbows and butterfly effect of, look what I did in my classroom. And then another teacher tries to do it and it doesn't work. And that other teacher thinks it's their fault or it's the technology's fault, instead of actually it's because it took 5 or 6 times to get this perfected before somebody shared it out. Share the dirty, right? Share the risk, share the failures along the way. And that's how we continue our community. So by no means am I saying mass exodus of Twitter. By no means am I saying you're doing wrong if you're promoting yourself, your book, your website, your podcast. By no means am I saying that. But what I'm saying is intermingle it with things that will help the classroom teacher, so that you are adding to the community of growth instead of other things. That's all I'm saying, you know. Kyle, any closing statements before we wind this down?
No, I think you said that very well. And same thing, I'm not shutting my stuff down. I just take things with a grain of salt. So I try to be a critical thinker about things. So that's my biggest thing that I would encourage listeners to do as well. So don't take everything that you see on social media as the gospel. So, and that it's something that's set in stone. It's the absolute truth. So, you know, question things. But at the same time, though, when question things using fact and not just letting things in your own mind and your belief system and your opinions to skew those things. So that's my biggest suggestion there. So, and again, with the self-promotion stuff, yeah, it's one thing to, you know, if you have written a book, to occasionally throw something out there about your book and how it could potentially be beneficial to somebody. But when that's all you tweet about, that turns some people off, myself included. But again, if that's your thing, that's your prerogative at the same time. So I think this has been a really great conversation about social media, and I would love to hear thoughts from listeners as well. So please connect with Joe and I both on the socials, connect with Sons of Technology EDU, Sons of Tech EDU, excuse me, on Twitter, hashtag EdTechArmy. Share out with us and your thoughts on things that we talked about today.
Yeah, and I'd also love to hear your thoughts, everybody, on what should the Twitter chat evolve into? What are some of your ideas to continue the discussion of community, but in a different way? What are your thoughts? What are you doing to move beyond a Twitter chat? Where have you gone? What do you do? I think that'd be a very interesting discussion topic as well. I'd love to hear your thoughts, everybody. But again, Kyle, I appreciate this conversation. I think it's timely and it's needed. A lot of people aren't going to agree with what you've said. A lot of people are still, you know, in deep with their Twitter accounts, and they are, you know, putting things out there that is bettering the ed tech community. So that's fantastic. Again, maybe the point of view that Kyle and I have is because we're outside the classroom at this moment. And so we have a different view, right? And so everybody's going to have a different view. Some views will be askew based upon your place in your career. So I understand all of those things. I just thought Kyle and I would love to be able to say that. And Kyle, I just realized right now it is 11:11 at 11:11. So I think this is a good time to stop at this time. So everybody, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for being part of the EdTech Army. And we promise we'll try and get more podcasts out in a more timely fashion. And where can you hear about this? Well, probably we'll promote it on Twitter. So have yourselves a wonderful, wonderful day.